It's my pleasure and it is an honor to introduce our speaker, Dr. Lerone A. Martin, Assistant Professor of the History of American Religion and Culture at Eden Theological Seminary. Professor Martin is a graduate of Anderson College and the Princeton Theological Seminary. Like our own Carol Litch and David Malott, he earned his PhD from Emory University, a limitation he's overcome by earning a reputation as an innovative and insightful public theologian. I warned him. Professor Martin's research emphasizes modern American religion and culture with special attention to African American cultural practices. His current book, under contract with New York University Press, investigates the role of the phonograph in the marketing and selling of American religion. Professor Martin's work has received support from an impressive array of institutions: the Louisville Institute for the Study of American Religion — Louisville is the correct pronunciation — Emory University's Howard Hughes Medical Institute, the Fund for Theological Education, and Princeton University's famous program in African American Studies. I find particularly noteworthy, personally, Professor Martin's role as a research fellow for Union Theological Seminary's New Media Project. You should check that out. His insights appear on CNN, Religion Dispatches, and Charisma Magazine, which featured his open letter to no less than Creflo Dollar. Professor Martin is licensed for ministry in the Church of God Anderson. He lives out his theological commitments by investing himself in community service. He's done consultation and research for New York's Sing Sing State Prison. He's taught classes in the Georgia State Prison. He won't have time for question and discussion immediately after the presentation here, though you may corner him in Mayor Common at the reception. Professor Martin will speak today on the topic, Let the Record Play: Religion, Media, and Mission in Early 20th Century America. Please welcome Professor Lerone A. Martin.
Thank you. If I can find my arms here out of this robe and not step on it, we can get started this morning. I want to thank the faculty, staff, President Litch, and the new dean, David Malott, for the invitation. I want to give a special thanks to a couple people who've really helped me feel at home here, to Dr. Valerie Bridgman for taking me out to breakfast this morning. And I also want to thank Elizabeth Harden. Is she here this morning? Elizabeth, hey, there you are. I want to put all her faculty on notice. She traveled to two airports yesterday to get me and to find me. So if she is dozing off in class, just today only, if she's dozing off in class today only, please charge it to Delta Airlines. So I won't hesitate. Let's get started. Ever since the Gregory Lecture was started in 1987, it stood for LTS's ethos of excellence, as well as steadfast commitment to preparing men and women for faith and leadership and scholarship and service. Since the first inaugural lecture of Dr. Gregory in 1987, entitled The Mandate for Evangelism, this message has challenged LTS and its hearers about how to engage the world for faith and service. Today, I hope to continue in this rich tradition by examining an understudied aspect of communication and evangelism in America. The evolution of communication technologies in America has continually revolutionized evangelism in this country. At least since the words, "What hath God wrought?" officially opened up America's long-range electronic telegraph wire in 1844. Religious adherents have interpreted the advancement of electric communication technology as a godsend for evangelism. For example, Reverend Gardner Spring excitedly praised the telegraph as bringing Christianity to, quote, to the border of a spiritual harvest because now thought travels by magnetic wires. The preacher believed that the emergence of new communication technologies would only enhance and further Christian mission in America and beyond. This popular perception of new media as a tool of divine purpose has contributed to each generation of American clergy and faith communities growing increasingly accustomed to engaging in outreach and evangelism via electronic mediums. American Christianity has continually harnessed the emerging media of the day for the purpose of evangelism, whether it be the telegraph, telephone, radio, television, film, the internet, and now, of course, social media such as Twitter, Facebook, and podcasting. One is hard-pressed today to find a faith community that is not engaging or at least feeling the pressure to engage in new media for the proliferation of the gospel and semblance of relevance in an ever-increasing digital and mobile society. The various disciplines which we employ to study religion in America have featured much work that chronicle this phenomenon. The field has been particularly strong in assessing the significance of mass mediums such as print, radio, film, television, and digital technologies in the practices of Protestant Christianity and evangelism. However, the field has been slow to recognize the phonograph or the record player as an equally vital tool in American religious media. The omission of this vibrant tradition limits our understanding of how current practices of religious media for outreach and evangelism and commodification have helped to formulate and configure religion in America. To this end, my aim for today, and it will be brief, is to bring our attention to the use of the phonograph or the record player as a mass medium of evangelism during the interwar period. I believe this excursion will provide us with a more panoramic view of such church work and provide us with insight for our contemporary context. With this in mind, I'll proceed like a preacher with three main points. First, I will establish the novel role of the phonograph by displaying the various ways in which the phonograph was a central medium in American life. As radio began its slow ascent as a religious medium on January 2, 1921, the phonograph was already the established primary medium of sound in American life. Next, I'll move forward with examining the phonograph's religious use. Namely, I will display and examine the popular and central role the phonograph played as a medium to transmit sermons to a population that was increasingly mobile, thanks to Ford, urban, and attached to the phonograph. Finally, I will conclude with some remarks and questions concerning how the specific long view of religion and media and evangelism via the phonograph might raise some questions for us and for our contemporary forms of media outreach. So first, the phonograph. In 1927, a resident of St. Peter's, Minnesota, was asked to reflect upon the significance of the phonograph in his life. He excitedly replied, quote, "I have bought everything that goes to make a home, from baby shoes to an electric washer, but nothing has given me more pleasure than my phonograph." Similarly, Miss Mary Kelly, a widow of five children living in Providence, Rhode Island, enthusiastically stated about her phonograph, quote, "I have had my life made worth living since the phonograph came into my home." She continued, "I got a small Edison phonograph on a 30-day trial, and believe me, it gave me such pleasure that I managed to get a larger one, and only wish I could own the very most elaborate one, as there is no case too grand for such a glorious machine." Now, no doubt you may be sitting here listening and finding it extremely odd to imagine that phonographs were the centerpiece in American homes and worthy of such excitement and joy. However, in the early 20th century, a world without established radio, let alone televisions and computers, the phonograph was indeed the central electronic medium offering a vast array of electronic, cultural, and entertainment experiences. Consumers extolled the phonograph as a life-altering device based in part upon the ability of the medium to bring popular cultural expressions into private homes. For example, Miss A.B. Cassiter of Richmond, Indiana, reflected the value of the home novelty when she wrote to Thomas Edison, "I can't tell you how much good you've done to make it possible for people to hear good music in their own homes," unquote. Similarly, Mr. William Slocum of Saginaw, Michigan wrote, "I find more real satisfaction and pleasure and amusement in my phonograph player than all other pleasures and amusements combined." Another customer expressed similar excitement regarding the phonograph. Marcus Mullen, a mechanical engineer from Chicago, said, "Coupled with his 15 tropical fish, nothing provided him with more pleasure than the phonograph." Customers also raved about the unprecedented ability of the phonograph to transmit important speeches and events across time and space. Similarly to our own contemporary bombardment of political commercials and addresses, collective sigh, those vying for the office of commander-in-chief during the early 20th century actually recorded campaign records. In an attempt to reach the broadest public, the often pro bono records featured a candidate's picture on one side and a brief stump speech on the other. And yes, even presidential debates, such as the contest between William H. Taft and William Jennings Bryan, was recorded on the phonograph and sold. Such utilization led citizens such as Frank Burns of right here in Pennsylvania to declare in 1921 that these recordings, quote, "bring the artist or player or singer or speaker right into your home." Moreover, Columbia Records even produced a record series covering the Scopes Monkey Trial. This most infamous trial was one of the biggest of national events in the early 20th century. The trial typified the fundamentalist-modernist cultural war that was waging in America, Protestant faith communities and institutions of higher learning. The 1925 trial convicted John Scopes of the sinister cultural heresy of teaching evolution in the classroom. While Chicago's WGN radio station broadcasted this trial, Columbia produced and recorded event-based songs retelling the events of the trial. Columbia employee Frank Walker recalled that they sold over 60,000 records on the courthouse steps in Dayton, Tennessee, adding that there were thousands of buyers of these phonograph records that had no other means of communication. Important sporting events also found their way on the phonograph. Jack Johnson, pictured here, was the first black heavyweight boxing champion and made several recordings, including a three-disc series retelling his historic victory over retired champion Jim Jeffries in the Great White Hope Bout of 1910. The racialized media extravaganza was recorded on silent film. However, the footage of the film of a triumphant Johnson was banned in several cities for fear of inciting race riots. Subsequently, Johnson teamed up with a recording label to make an audible recreation of the fight. The phonograph permitted admirers and, of course, many foes alike to experience a firsthand account of the famous or perhaps infamous fight round by round as told by Johnson on the record player. Lawrence Dreger of Pittsburgh enthusiastically proclaimed that such records brought the artist or speaker into his home, and with a little imagination, he could see the fighter standing in his midst. Before sports radio, there was the phonograph. In addition to music, speeches, and cultural events, the phonograph was also employed as an educational medium. Such records included typewriter lessons, games, as well as children's songs and stories such as Jack and Jill, Old King Cole, and Simple Simon. Moreover, schools utilized oration records that featured educational lectures on various subjects, ranging from American history to zoology. School teacher Ann Pike Greenwood raved when her local school district purchased its first phonograph in 1914. She gratefully wrote to the phonograph company, "You would appreciate all it means if you could see the light in my pupils' eyes as they gather around the machine to hear the records." By 1927, the phonograph, as you can see here in this graph, in a nationwide survey, the phonograph was more numerous in American homes in 1927 than radios. The study revealed that in cities with a population of 100,000 or more, 60% of households possessed at least one phonograph, compared to 50% owning cars and 26% owning radios. The phonograph was increasingly a mainstay in American homes. The phonograph industry attempted to make the sound and information medium available to all. Phonographs, similar to our flat-screen televisions and tablet PCs today, came in a host of values and amenities. Record players came furnished with various wood finishes, as seen here, as well as sizes ranging from large cabinets to miniature travel phonographs for those traveling trips. As seen in this 1918 advertisement, the phonograph industry offered players in the price range of $22.50 to $900. This at a time when the average American family income was approximately $1,500 a year. Regardless of aesthetic tastes, listening practices, or income, there was indeed a phonograph suited for almost everyone, making the medium seemingly ubiquitous in American life in the early 20th century. Now, the centrality of the phonograph in American culture, as well as its potential to transmit voices across space and time, did not escape the purview of clergy. Like the internet or Facebook today, clergy flocked to use the most popular medium of the day for evangelism and outreach. Notable clergy during the early 20th century, such as Amy Simple McPherson and Billy Sunday, used the phonograph to record and widely distribute their sermons. However, many innovative clergy, particularly McPherson, opted to primarily focus their resources on the new wireless technology known as radio. However, African-American clergy were, with few exceptions, largely marginalized from radio in the early 20th century. Nevertheless, the popularity of African-American jazz and blues artists on the phonograph opened the industry door to black Protestant clergy as major labels sought to sign black clergy and hire them to record and sell their sermons. African-American clergy who garnered such contracts from leading labels recorded and sold their sermons across the nation. During the short span of 16 years, from 1925 to 1941, approximately 100 black clergy recorded some 800 sermons from more than 20 different record labels, sparking an evangelistic media phenomenon. These innovative preachers capitalized on the popularity of the phonograph and used it to reach out and evangelize a population that was increasingly electronic and glued to their sound mediums. Now, the sermons. In 1925, African Methodist Episcopal pastor Reverend Calvin P. Dixon recorded 10 sermons for Columbia Records, making him the first African-American clergy to record a phonograph sermon for commercial use. The Rome, Georgia clergyman adopted the recording name of Black Billy Sunday after traveling revivalist and religious celebrity Billy Sunday. The pioneering black religious broadcaster recorded 10 sermons over the course of 3 consecutive days in Columbia's New York City studios. The preacher's repertoire included such sermons as An Eagle Stirreth Up Her Nest and The Prodigal Son. And this advertisement here is found in the Chicago Defender when the sermons were released. The bevy of men and women who followed Reverend Dixon preached sermons that addressed numerous topics of faith and evangelism. For example, Reverend White from Chicago preached sermons such as A Divine Relationship of God to Man to inform his listeners of the sin of evolution. This advertisement boasts that White's sermon solves the question of evolution, the greatest religious topic that has so stirred the country. Reverend Leora Ross was one of the first women to record and distribute her sermons. Her sermon, as pictured here, warned migrants of the dangers of living in a city of dry bones, especially to women. As you can see here from the advertisement, the protagonist is even dressed as a woman would in the city in the 1920s. She's got heels on, she's got a short bobbed haircut, and she's pictured as someone who's in the city who has perhaps lost her way. And this sermon is served to help her find her way. Meanwhile, Reverend James Gates of Atlanta preached the good news of God's care and provision during the Great Depression with such sermons as No Breadline in Heaven. These sermons addressed issues of the day, and the phonograph provided these preachers with a broader reach. Such efforts to use the phonograph to evangelize the broader public also reflected and facilitated prominent shifts in American Christianity and media. Let's briefly examine two. The first, as I've already shown, is marketing and advertising. The advertisements I've shown for the phonograph sermons were displayed in a myriad of venues. Leading record labels recorded and sold these spiritual commodities utilizing posters, handbills, department stores, record label shops, furniture stores, mail order catalogs such as Sears and Montgomery Ward, and nationally circulated African-American newspapers such as the Chicago Defender, the Pittsburgh Courier, the Baltimore African-American, and the Norfolk Journal and Guide. And even later, radio broadcasts were used to advertise these latest sermon releases. In this regard, recorded sermons reflected America's shifts at this time from a producer to a consumer economy. During the early 20th century, the home, once the place of the production of food, clothing, and other goods, turned into a place of consumption as these functions were turned over to largely chain stores and department stores. These stores provided everything that was formerly produced at home, including recorded sermons. So in this regard, recorded sermons offered a new form of commodity, a spiritual and religious commodity. To this end, as this Pittsburgh Courier advertisement shows, these evangelistic records were placed on the market shelf alongside increasing number of goods and commodities. As you can see here, the sermon is advertised sort of right in the middle of advertisement for beauty culture. And what does this mean, sort of placing sermons on the market as a place to purchase a commodity? These evangelistic efforts of phonograph preachers were thrust into the marketplace alongside a host of goods, as well as gospel, jazz, and blues, and classical and comedy records. Not to mention, again, canned goods, appliances, and other non-essential items. Recorded sermons were forced to compete for the spiritual affections as well as the patronage of the public. The advertising and marketing of these sermons did indeed bolster the spread of the gospel via media evangelism. These sermons were made available across the country to people in their homes who ordinarily would not be able to hear these sorts of sermons from preachers from all across the nation. However, the sermons also had the dual effect of contributing to the anointing of the consumer marketplace as the place to obtain happiness, fulfillment, spiritual formation, and religious instruction. The cost of these sermons is telling of how much such advertisements reaped benefits. As posters of these modern celebrity preachers donned the shopping windows of local recording shops, furniture stores, and department stores, consumers lined up to purchase the latest sermon, which was priced at 75 cents to $1.25. Put in context, this was a significant price tag during the interwar period. In fact, the cost of a new sermon amounted to roughly the average price of bread in the 1920s, or, said another way, twice the average hourly wage of laborers during this time period. Nevertheless, despite this significant price tag, consumers eagerly purchased these sermons. And some of these preachers even outsold leading blues and jazz artists of the day, such as Bessie Smith, Duke Ellington, and Louis Armstrong. So this brings me to my second point, and that is the issue of religious celebrity. Phonograph sermons contributed to our current understanding of media outreach as well as the prevalence of religious celebrity. To be sure, this period of American religion has long been characterized by the rise of celebrity preachers and religious media icons such as Amy Simple McPherson, Harry Emerson Fosdick, and Sweet Daddy Grace and Father Divine. However, the novelty of phonograph sermons, the wide distribution networks of major record labels, coupled with the wide circulation of advertising and marketing, had the net result of also creating and making phonograph sermon preachers as celebrities and media icons. And their efforts to utilize popular media for evangelistic purposes, the preachers also became celebrities in the process. Kansas City pastor Reverend J.C. Burnett, for example, became a nationally known preacher for his sermon, The Downfall of Nebuchadnezzar. It was the highest-selling sermon during this time period. The congregational singing and antiphonal sermon was recorded and released in January of 1927, and before the year had ended, it had sold 90,000 copies. This total was far more than Bessie Smith's latest release on the same record label. Reverend James Gates offers another example. The preacher recorded over 200 titles during his recording career. He became extremely popular with such sermons as Death's Black Train is Coming, which warned of the perils of urban living, and Getting Ready for Christmas Day, a sermon that, oddly enough, has been recently sampled by Paul Simon on his latest album of a song of the same title, Getting Ready for Christmas Day. The sermon, as well as Paul Simon's song sampling it, covers the more weighty matters of Christmas and how perhaps consumer capitalism overtakes the more weighty matters of Christmas. Such sermons outsold, as I said before, artists such as Ethel Waters and other leading artists. Joe Luttrell, who was the manager of the Atlanta Phonograph Company, noted that one of the preacher's sermons was so hugely popular, he stated, quote, "Never before in the time have I been connected with the phonograph business has there been such a demand for a record. It's impossible for us to keep this sermon in the store." One newspaper reporter said of Reverend Gates, "You may say what you may about the preacher, but we do have a celebrity in the person of Reverend James Gates." With such notoriety, these innovative preachers, both literally and figuratively, as you'll see in this next slide, took their place alongside the leading commercial icons of the day, as this advertisement displays here, with Reverend Gates' sermon being advertised right alongside Louis Armstrong and Victoria Spivey and even Duke Ellington. These national circulated publicity and commercial success of utilizing the phonograph as a medium of evangelism did provide, again, a way of reaching out to a broader public, particularly a public who was increasingly mobile. However, it also had the dual effect of providing notoriety and adulation normally reserved for athletes, movie stars, and entertainers. This tradition, as we all know, has been bequeathed to us in contemporary mass media religious entrepreneurs and religious advertisers such as Joel Osteen and T.D. Jakes. Now, having briefly examined this phenomenon and the role of the phonograph in American life as an evangelistic tool, I want to conclude with some remarks sort of that are aimed at what is the meaning of all this, besides maybe a bunch of cool information. At least I think it's cool. Said another way, I want to sort of close with brief musings about how the examination of phonograph sermons during this time period might help us to think about or perhaps inform us and our evangelistic efforts and using media for religious purposes. The first is power. As I mentioned earlier, African-American Protestant phonograph preachers were in many ways marginalized from the emerging medium of the radio and relegated to the phonograph because of racial prejudice. Such systematic disparity still exists with us today. That is to say, while commentators would like to assure us that media has made the world flat, we know in reality that racial and economic disparities continue to limit access to certain kinds of media. In this regard, the world is not flat, but it is indeed spiked. Subsequently, in our efforts to utilize religious media, we must be conscious of how race and socioeconomic status influences access to media, as well as who produces and who consumes media. Our nation runs the gamut of wealthy suburbs that are equipped with Wi-Fi access throughout entire neighborhoods and schools, and also to schools that don't even have computers. Therefore, our outreach to the world and service must be cognizant of how such disparities both shape us and shape our perception of those we seek and claim to serve. The second one and the final one is proclamation. The communication of religious messages via different media throughout American history has always introduced not just new ways of proclaiming and communicating the message of the gospel, but has also given us new ways and forms of being religious and practicing religion and new forms of community. Accordingly, the phonograph created a new way of utilizing a popular medium to proclaim and communicate the gospel and receive and practice religion at home. This new proclamation helped spread the gospel in unprecedented ways, to be sure. However, this proliferation was shaped by the time parameters of the medium itself. Phonograph preachers, therefore, had to shape their sermons in conformity with such time and space parameters, thus shaping the theological form and substance of their sermons. Simply put, in many ways, the medium is the message. Therefore, in our efforts to understand and use contemporary religious media, and to broaden our reach and scope, it will behoove us then to ponder how the parameters of such mediums of Facebook, Twitter, podcasts, and the internet, for example, actually shape the content and theology of our religious messages. For example, what does the shortening of expression via Twitter mean for religious leaders and communities that are bound together by narratives and the power of story that are longer than 140 characters? That is to say, as people of the book, are we cultivating a tweeted and soundbite religion in our reliance of such mediums as opposed to one of narrative and story? Can Christians actually make sense and understand Moses' commandments without cultivating an engagement of the longer narrative of the Exodus story? Can the red highlighted tweets of Jesus be properly understood apart from the larger story of Jesus' life on the margins? In addition to thinking about the parameters of the medium, our efforts of proclamation must attune to other influences such as market forces. As I've shown here before, phonograph sermons were influenced both by record company executives and marketing firms that had, at the end of the day, a beeline for the bottom line. For example, Reverend Gates has recorded a sermon in opposition to the growth of chain stores in 1929. His sermon was really sort of a precursor to what we hear about Walmart today and how large box stores decimate local economies. However, as you can imagine, as his sermons were sold in such chain stores, the record label decided not to place the sermon on the market shelf because the sermon was obviously antithetical to profit. So despite his rising celebrity and broad appeal, the preacher was in many ways limited in his proclamation of the gospel. Like phonograph preachers, then, we must consider how market forces and financing, and that ranges from wealthy parishioners to international media platforms and everything in between, how might these market forces and finances shape our religious discourse? Our service in the world must be attentive to how the financiers, owners, and producers of media outlets possess the power to shape the very tenor of our voices. Evangelism and religious media can certainly broaden one's reach and offer the platform of celebrity. However, we must not confuse the breadth of reach with depth. We must consider the possibilities and limits of using media for evangelistic purposes and speaking the truth to power can both amplify our voices and perhaps attenuate them as well. In close, I would just say that examining how media has continually shifted America's religious landscape is indeed key to understanding the theological changes in America and thus a key to understanding how to engage in such church work. As leaders and scholars of religious communities, we must seek more than just mastering media acumen. We must seek more than just how to be the fastest Twitter follower, have the most Twitter followers, and so on, and the most Facebook friends. Rather, we must seek to understand and engage our increasingly media culture by not only utilizing the tools of media, but also those of history that detail to us how mediums have historically influenced the theological and religious meanings and formulations of religious proclamations and practices. Only then can we engage in faithful service and truly let the record play. Thank you.